Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello and happy Memorial Day to all of you, wherever you are. I hope you are enjoying some magnificent weather here in the Pacific Northwest. I swear, the rain gods have been angry again because they've decided to deluge us. I don't know why, but you know what? Apparently, we've been beating our tom-toms enough because we just had a break in the gray skies. We actually have blue up in the wild blue yonder that's showing itself through, but rain's on its way. So even though this is a holiday, I know that it is a wonderful time for you to be able to rest and relax. And we have a wonderful guest today talking about a subject matter that so frequently we do not want to look at. And what is that? That is health care for end of life. So we're going to be discussing that. My guest is Damiano Iacovazzi. And he has put together some information because of his professional background that he feels is going to be of value to you. I want to welcome you, Damiano, to the show.
Thank you very much.
Now, it's interesting. You have served on the Committee for Biomedical Ethics for the California Nursing Association in San Francisco, California. And for over 23 years, you have been very, very dedicated to working with people in end-of-life care. You have various applications you've done this in. You're also a college instructor. And for you, this has been an especially significant, I'll call it a passion. And inasmuch as so many people are going to be living to be 100 or older, and many of them will need care, how is it that you found yourself following this particular life path?
Well, I came out of the Peace Corps in 1979, and I met all my friends in San Francisco from Morocco, and we all took a house together, and I was a language person in my previous existence. I went to school in Europe, and I'm actually Italian background. But I drove a bus, and I gave tours. And all of a sudden, all of people I used to know were beginning to die of the AIDS epidemic around 1981. Mm. And in those days, there was not much to do about HIV, and it didn't even have a name yet. So I found myself becoming a caregiver to people who were thrown away at that time, because even doctors and nurses and families wouldn't touch an AIDS patient. Mm-hmm. Nobody even knew where it came from. So I and a few friends started to take care of our friends and acquaintances, and I often took care of them in my home. That's how I became a caregiver.
Well, I can tell just from your voice that this was an extremely emotional time for you, but it also led you to a calling. I mean, how many people are going to be working on a committee for biomedical ethics? Tell us a bit about that committee. What is a biomedical ethic committee? What do they do? And how much of a positioning of influence and importance do they have relative to patient care?
Well, ethics is a study of human behavior in a hospital setting or a clinical setting or even a home setting. And ethics is an applied philosophy. And it helps people understand our lifespan and how to do things in a correct way with a code of honor and a code of conduct. The California Nursing Association has a biomedical ethics committee, much like most hospitals. And what a biomedical ethics committee does is it provides advice and recommendations. For example, if I were working in a hospital, I would be on a biomedical ethics committee. And what happens is if the nurses or doctors feel that a certain patient case needs to come before the biomedical ethics committee because the family is jumpy or the care isn't going the way they should, the family's demanding everything that the providers can do for them, even though it just may be medically futile, the biomedical ethics committee will review the case and make a recommendation. The recommendations are not binding. It's just advice. And they cite ethical models, which are ancient, coming from the times of the Greeks. So the biomedical ethics committees are just advice panels. They don't regulate anything. Just because a committee says, you know, you don't have to do everything for this patient, it doesn't mean that it will happen. It actually depends on the patient, who is compos mentis. That means that the patient is understanding and awake and alert, or if not, then the family, the person who is caring for the patient, who is the closest, will decide.
Well, that gives us some information on that particular organization. You have walked a walk of very unique experiences. You have done everything from delivering a baby, or being present when the baby decided it was going to arrive in a parked car. I mean, babies have a tendency of doing that. And you have also sat at the side of friends that are dying. And I know that I do not have as much experience in that arena as you do, but I know that when you are at the side of someone who is transitioning out of this life experience, it really can be a very, very special gift. And if people are prepared to deal with that, it is something in our society I think many times people are terrified of. Now, you put this book together, Sooner
Right.
or Later, Restoring Sanity to Your End-of-Life Care. You did this for a reason. The book is very compact and to the point. What did you feel that was so important with all of these interactions during the 23 years you've had with people, whether they're being born or they're leaving this earth in their final days? Why was this so significant? Why did you say, I need to put this out there?
It was for many reasons, Donna. There is no book like it at all. I think that it may be a landmark book like Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's On Death and Dying, because nobody really talks about it. The book provides all the questions to ask specialists during the opinion phases. And this book is actually written for everybody who's well or ill, because I think it makes us appreciate our time on this planet. If we have 72 years, we have about 26,000 days. So how are we going to spend our lives? How are we going to do the greatest good? The book allows people to live in a space of their lifetime with joy, even if it's until the last day, because in my opinion, I always have lived my life like an existentialist. And in that way, that I know that I only have a limited amount of time on this planet, so what kind of good am I going to do here? What kind of significance am I going to have? What kind of memory am I going to leave for people? And I think if I had to die tomorrow, I would probably, that's a tall. Did you want to go ahead and talk?
Oh, well, you bleeped out there for a minute, so I think you must have a message.
Yes, okay.
And that's why I was just listening, because I heard you disappear for
a moment there.
Okay, great. All right, well, what I wanted to do was bring out some of the points of information that you have in your book. One is that you say it's very important that you say what you mean and mean what you say. That is the title, in fact, of your second chapter in
Right.
your book. And you say organize family conferences. Now, this can be a very, very touchy issue, because many times, especially in our culture, this isn't with some cultures throughout the world, but in the Western culture, dealing with the actual reality that someone's dying, in today's world, it's like watching Logan's Run. No, we don't have that. We'll just evaporate them. We just, you know, we're not going to feel anything.
Right.
And when someone's in that phase, when they are going out, it may take them 2 weeks or it might take 10 years.
Right.
But you're dealing with issues that are very significant. And they're financial issues.
Right.
They are caretaking issues. And you have a number of questions. When you've worked with patients, there are people that will say, I don't even want to discuss this. How do you get around it? Because I've had families that have come to me and said, Donna, it's driving me crazy. I have got an elderly mother here, And I cannot get her to do a will. I can't get her to pay attention to things. She thinks I'm going to rob her. And those things happen. I'm not saying they don't.
Right.
But how can you, what have you done in working with families and with individuals to make them realize that this is just good common sense to really look at preparation? It doesn't mean you want them to die tomorrow, but it means, what are you going to do?
Well, I think that I lived abroad much of my time, and I lived in Africa for a long time where death is very common, actually. Death comes to everybody, and most people have a very positive and healthy attitude regarding their own end, and because it's much more common. In the United States, we shun illness. Even when I talk to different blogs, like the American Medical Association, there's this whole wellness and cure, rah-rah, we can do, you know, nobody has to die type thing. And in my opinion, it's completely false because everybody's going to have to go sooner or later.
Yes, but we all have an expiration date, don't we?
That's right, we do. And there's no U-Haul on any hearse I've ever seen.
So, I like that one. Okay.
So it's really important that we realize that we're going to go. But we do live in a society of denial. We think if we deny it enough, it's going to go away and not come for us. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, in her landmark book on death and dying in 1969, talked about that in the introduction. And it goes back to a psychological state of being a child. And you know that a child is very egocentric. Nobody can have fun without the child in the house. The world can't turn on its axis without the child. And the child cannot imagine a personal death for himself because it's just so, it's too absurd because he's the center of the universe. And I think for many, even adults, we still have this inner child that thinks that no life occurred before our existence and no life can occur after our existence. And it's something I think that we rebel against. We don't go quietly into that dark of night at all, and most of us are just terrified about it.
Well, how do you work with those that are terrified?
It's very, very hard. It's very, very hard. The book that I've written is a distillation of bedside knowledge that comes from 23 years of taking care of everybody that I know. Patients, family members, a spouse. It's just a distillation of that knowledge. And this book concerns itself if you've been given a diagnosis that tells you that you probably will not be alive in 6 months. So this is what you do next.
Mm-hmm.
And it brings you to a safe harbor in your mind because people go crazy when they get that, and the families get unhinged. There's so much going on in the families that everybody's kind of out of control, including the patient that this has happened to. So this book helps anchor everybody. If you read it, there's all the questions that help you process all the emotions. It gives them names. It's just not a jumble of crazy fears.
Mm-hmm.
It helps you, because it gives names to what you're feeling, you understand it's perfectly normal. When you go into the opinion phases of a diagnosis, let's say somebody has a returning cancer of the breast that's in the bones and in the brain now, what are you going to do? Well, this book helps ground you. It helps ground the patient. It helps ground the family in reality. And that's something that we don't get with most healthcare providers because nobody has time to explain anything to you.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when I'm working in clinic, they book a patient every 5 minutes for me. It's very, very difficult.
Oh,
so,
for heavens, every 5 minutes?
Every 5 or 10 minutes I get somebody. So
that is an assembly line process.
It is called industrial medicine, and that's just what's happened in the United States. We don't have a lot of time. It's not the country doctor anymore, not the country nurse who has all the time in the world to spend with a family. We really don't. But I think if doctors and nurses and social workers provide the book to people in this predicament who have less than 6 months to live, it helps ground them. It also gives all the questions to ask all the specialists so that you know that if you have 3 opinion conferences with different providers, including a social worker, that you understand that this disease that you have is progressive and it's terminal, and probably at the end of 6 months or so, you will have departed this world. But what does that mean for the person? It can mean a lot of things. The book tries to tell people that it's okay. You have a beginning and you have an end. What you want to avoid is what I call the nightmare of medical futility. That is, people running to every single specialist, spending all their good days in some specialist office looking for cures that never will be coming. It wastes people's good time. Also, it tells people about writing an advanced health care directive. And it explains what everything is, because most people don't know, because they're not critical care nurses or doctors. They don't know what goes on in a code blue. They watch TV programs where there's always a happy ending. But this tells people in no uncertain words what you will endure if you are deemed terminal and you decide to pursue a cure orientation.
Mm-hmm.
A code blue is a very violent process. A huge tube is introduced into your mouth that goes into your lungs. You are on a breathing machine. If you survive getting your chest pounded and breathing on this machine or with a bag and are transferred to ICU, it is a medical nightmare. Nobody knows what to do, and I did this for 23 years as a critical care nurse. It's torture, because you're going to lose that whole wonderful experience of you staying in control at home. You have specialists parading in and out of the room at all hours, calling all their friends, but they may be proposing treatments for you. You may be going to get more diagnostics, but it's not going to change anything. It's
mm-hmm.
just a Band-Aid, and it may even shorten your life. So I'll let you go ahead and ask me more questions.
Well, one of the points that you've brought out that I think is a very good one is the quality of life. And
right.
instead of being afraid of death, ask yourself, is there going to be quality of life? And that is why I think patient advocates are so valuable. Because if you are made aware of a particular judgment, and if you decide you want to go through X, Y, Z, I was talking with someone that was graced with a liver transplant. This was just a week ago.
Uh-huh.
And they would have been dead in 3 months. So they had this wonderful blessing of being able to get a liver transplant, and
right.
they're out there walking around.
Right.
But they're very much aware of certain realities, too. They're aware
right.
that their immune system is not operational, that they have to be very, very careful about being in public places. They have to
right.
be very careful about things, because the body has to make its adaptations and adjustments.
Right.
So this person has been given what I call a grace, that is going to either work or not work.
Right.
But he said he feels very, very fortunate.
Right.
However, this person, if he had not had the benefit of what we call the modern medical environment,
right.
that would have given him that option, he would have been God in a short
right.
period of time.
Right, right.
So these things really do need to be prepared for, and people need to know about hospice. People need to know about the facts that of what you're going to deal with, because economics come into this, and the pressure and the stress on family is just
right.
absolutely incredible. Now, one of the comments that you make that I really appreciated was in the preface of your book. You had a personal experience when you were growing up at an upstate New York funeral home in the Adirondacks.
Right.
Share that experience, because that used to be common, and it's
right.
not anymore.
My father was Italian, and he wanted to become a physician, but unfortunately they were children during the Depression, so there was never any money. But in World War II, he joined the Navy, and he did become a licensed mortician. That was what the best the Navy could do for him, so he did, and he had a wonderful business in upstate New York, and he had a monument business and all that. So we actually lived in the house upstairs that was the mortuary. And it was very ethnic. My father buried mostly Italian people. And for Italians, it was actually a reason for a party. So I always thought it was party time when I was little, because it was like the barber shop. Everybody would arrive. They'd all be visiting, talking. All you needed was a cocktail, but they weren't served. So, on the day of the funeral, everybody went to the family's house, and there were more parties. So it was really a time. It was a kind of a celebration, I think. I mean, there were people mourning and crying and things like that, but it was nice because communities were communities back then, and you were never really alone. Even if you knew a person peripherally, you still would show up for the funeral and for the parties afterwards.
And, well, I know in early America, that was something that there was that celebration in the home. They often, I can remember my grandparents talking about this. Of course, they were from Virginia, but they lived on farms. And the local mortician, you know, they might have to take care of somebody else, but it was always held in the living room. The casket was there, everything was there, and proper preparation was done. In fact, it wasn't unusual for family members to actually tend to the care of the body of the person that had passed over. And I know maybe some of my listeners are going to be shivering and going, oh, you got to be kidding. No, this was a part of life.
It was more natural then. Everybody wasn't divorced or on their iPods or, you know, on their telephones. It was an America that's long gone. It was a community that's long gone. We don't have that. I mean, most people are really, really, really alone. And there isn't, I've seen that also taking care of people in hospice and in my clinic. You often can't even find anybody to go sit with a person. They sometimes even die alone. There's nobody that's available, a volunteer, to go and hold their hand or talk to them in their lap.
That brings to mind Mother Teresa, because that's what her work was all about.
She's one of my heroes.
Yes, and I can understand why. That woman just, she left a legacy that was absolutely phenomenal. And as tiny and petite as she was a powerhouse.
She changed the world, didn't she?
She really did. She really brought things to the forefront and saying the most important thing was to bring dignity and to let them know that they were loved, and she made sure that they were clean and they were all in their final moments. But she said having death with dignity was very important. You have a poem by Audrey Hepburn that I thought was very, very significant. She was such a beautiful, gracious woman, and I'd like to share it with my audience. For attractive lips speak words of kindness. For lovely eyes seek out the good in people. For poise walk with the knowledge that you never walk alone. People, even more than things, have to be restored, renewed, and redeemed. Never throw out anyone. Remember, if you ever need a helping hand, you'll find one at the end of each arm. As you grow older, you will discover that you have two hands, one for helping yourself and one for helping others. She was quite a lady, and she had a very difficult time towards the end of her life.
She did.
I think that those words that she shared that you have put so well in your book really convey a very important message, and that is that we need to make choices and decisions. And if we choose not to go through certain treatments, and I've known many individuals who have said, if this is the end of my ride in this roller coaster of life, that's fine, I'm ready to go. There are others that are going to say, no, let's try this, that, or the other. And that's always, in my view, the right and privilege of the individual. But I like the questions that you present. And this is where someone needs to have a patient advocate, because maybe if you're not really feeling well and you've had some medicine and something is just not working for you, questions like, who will benefit from the treatment? I like the attitude, Damien, that you have in here where you say, physicians are not gods. Don't let somebody talk you into something without really thinking about it and asking yourself if it's quality of life. I have a very good friend and someone that I've known for over 20 years that is a medical professional. And she even went so far in her will to state she was not going to in any way accept any kind of chemotherapy or radiation because she had seen so much. She said, I want quality of life. She said, I do not want to go through what I have seen so many patients go through. So her family understands this, and she put it in writing so that nobody would go against it. But your questions, again, I'll go on with them. Would this test you're proposing tell you something you already know, something you don't know? And this is being thoughtful. Are we going to be spending excessive money on things that really are not necessary? How will the information from the test affect the course of the illness? What new treatments can benefit me? Are they experimental? What's going on? What do you see as long-term? And, again, don't be afraid to ask a physician this. Actually, many times doctors are terrified of these questions. Why?
Yeah. I really don't know. I think it all has to do with the education and the orientation in medical schools. That is, patients who have exhausted every medical option, they really don't know what to do with anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can't affect a cure or remission, and it's kind of a failure where I know many of my colleagues still think that death is a failure, and so they kind of abandon patients to the nursing department or to social work or to hospice or whatnot, because there's very little that the physician can do for a family and for the patient anymore. There's no treatment, they've exhausted everything. And
mm-hmm.
that happens a lot of times with the stage 4 returning cancers, that there's very little to do anymore because any further treatment could harm the patient or kill the patient
mm-hmm.
and also take away good quality of life. So it's a different kind of model than, say, the nursing model, which incorporates the medical model but also understands there's a beginning and an end. And even for a patient who is going into his last 6 months, it's a time to maximize the time he has left so he can make a legacy, make memories, get off his chest, do a trip, have some fun, live, love, and laugh, even to the final moment. That's really what Auntie Mame proclaimed and what Rosalind Russell played, Auntie Mame, live, 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 even into your last breath. That's the whole point of the book.
I agree. And I've known people that have adopted that modality, and they have left a phenomenal legacy.
Right.
Because they said, I am going to live my life with whatever. If it means that I'm going to be gardening, I'll be gardening. If it means
right.
that I'm going to be on a jet plane going to Morocco, that's terrific.
Right.
But I want to live my life. I just
right.
don't want to exist with it. And I think that that is such an important note. Now, the Advanced Health Care Directive, you say in California that there is a form. Is there a website that people can go to? Because
yes.
there may be some of my listeners that are dealing with family members or have friends that are dealing with family members. I don't see this as an ugly subject to talk about, because I think it's important that we be aware. That
right, I agree.
We think about this. And I think that it's not being morbid. I don't think it's being negative in any way. But where can we go to get some information regarding this? Because there may be somebody listening there today that is saying, gee, where can I go to find out about this Advanced Health Care Directive?
Well, if you don't have a computer, you can always go to the library. And the library will download a copy of the Advanced Health Care Directive from your state. Every state has a different one, but they're basically the same. What happens is, if you get my book, I'll walk you through the whole Advanced Health Care Directive process and answer your questions as you're doing it and explaining everything so that you understand what the choices are, because it's kind of written in medicalese, which is, it may be above the elevation of what people are comfortable. But this book will explain to the reader what kind of questions they need to answer and how they should answer them according to their own wishes without a lot of medicalese. My book is written for people around the seventh grade level, so anybody who's got a good reading skill can understand the book. So, and it's not difficult at all. It's like I'm talking to an aunt or an uncle explaining
mm-hmm.
everything to them.
Mm-hmm.
What you do is, if you don't have a library near you, you can, the next visit that you go see your physician, what you can do is you can ask at the front desk for a copy of the Advanced Health Care Directive, and you can take it home, go over it with your relatives. You can use my book, I say, as a reference to help you understand, because a lot of times nobody in the office will have time to go over it with you. People are just so busy. But this book will help a lot because it'll answer a lot of the questions. What you do is, the basic question in the Advanced Health Care Directive is, do you want life support? And life support means cardiopulmonary resuscitation. That means if you call 911, the paramedics or firemen will arrive. If you don't have an Advanced Health Care Directive and you're in a lot of distress or can't breathe, they will put you on a breathing machine. If your heart's doing flip-flops, they will begin CPR on you, and they will transfer you to the closest emergency department. Only about 15% of patients who undergo the Code Blue actually survive it, so it's a very, very low level. If the reader or someone in the reader's family has a terminal diagnosis and has less than 6 months to live, it's not a good idea to choose CPR and advanced cardiac life support, because it's not going to do anything to alter what's going to happen to the patient. So way, way in advance, at the time of death, it's best to really understand that and get involved with a hospice visiting nurses association. There's two questions. The first one is, if I'm going down, death is within a couple of hours, do I want CPR and advanced cardiac life support? You either say yes or you say no. For patients who are already been diagnosed with a terminal diagnosis and who have less than 6 months to live, I recommend that they put the no option. And at that point, they should talk to a social worker or their physician or healthcare provider and have the visiting nurses come to the home, and they will step up care as the patient needs. That's actually the gist of the Advanced Healthcare Directive.
I think that this information is invaluable. Your book, Sooner or Later, Restoring Sanity to End-of-Life Care, is so concise and so direct. I really think, Damiano, you've done a wonderful job. Now, do you have a website people can go to?
Yes, I do. It's called soonerorlaterbook.com, all one word, soonerorlaterbook.com.
Wonderful. Soonerorlaterbook.com is the website to go to. Hey, maybe pass the information along to a friend. I don't know. It seems like all of us are going to know about someone that can use some assistance. This book is really great. Damiano, I think it's a delight having you as a guest.
Thank you for calling me.
It has been a pleasure. And Damiano Vacovazzi is his name, and I'll spell it for you, I-O-C-O-V-O-Z-Z-I. And I think that you're doing a wonderful service, and you are really in the right profession because you really
care
about people.
Thank you,
Donna. This is Donna Sebo. It's my pleasure. This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break. We're going to be back in just a moment. Don't go away.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature. However, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
Hello, this is Donna. Telephone lines are now open. If you'd like to call in and chat, the telephone number to call in to is 888-815-9756. That's 888-815-9756. Well, today is Memorial Day, and I know so many of you have enjoyed and are continuing to enjoy your 3-day weekend, which is absolutely marvelous. I do want to let you know my email newsletter will be going out at 5:30 this afternoon Pacific time, and in it you're going to be finding all kinds of good information, including details about upcoming broadcasts that I am going to be doing on other stations. And in the newsletter, we're going to have information about upcoming guests. Now, I haven't posted all of the guests on the BBS radio website, but just know that is going to be coming up. So I am going to be giving that information to you. If you are looking for it, you will find that by 9 o'clock Pacific this evening. All of the guests for the month of June are going to be up there ready for you to view. So I will be giving you information on that within, well, just a few hours. All of the details will be there. In a little bit, I will give you the information on the guests that are going to be coming up. In fact, let me get that list out, because this week is going to be quite an involved week. We're going to be talking about fulfillment using real conscience with Dr. Xavier, and that's going to be tomorrow. And then on Wednesday, we're going to be having upbeat music. It's absolutely going to be awesome. Trish Hatley is going to be my guest. We're going to be listening to jazz and then some wonderful music that's called Sing, Ask, and It Is Given. If you ever want to have some positive affirmations and maybe tiptoe around or put it on your iPod, this music will make you feel good. Trish just has a wonderful voice. On Thursday, we're going to be doing the Best of Donna. We're going to have a replay of a program because I am on the road traveling Wednesday and Thursday. So this is what you're going to be hearing of the Best of Donna on Thursday. And then we're going to be interviewing on Friday David Nuffer. David Nuffer has done a lot of research on a man that many of you, I'm sure, have heard of, Ernest Hemingway. Fascinating information about a man that has so many myths about him. You know the one about his residence and all the cats? We're going to get the lowdown on that on Friday. So we've got an intriguing, interesting, eclectic week. I invite you to join us. And do tell your friends, because we always have a wonderful lineup of people with stories and information and detail that either you can use or maybe you can pass it along to someone else. Speaking of passing something along, how about passing along your story? Your story of a paranormal experience, whether it is a near-death experience, a ghost story, could be talking about the communication with animals. I really don't care, because paranormal experiences happen in so many different ways and on so many different levels. But I'd like to have yours. The reason? Because I am putting together a book, and I'm collecting 100 stories. We're getting close to 30 now, so the goal is 100, and I'd love to have yours. Send it to Donna at DelphiInternational.com. That's Donna at DelphiInternational.com. And we're going to put it in a file, and then I'm putting the content and everything together for the book, and your story may well be included. So be sure to put your contact information when you send me your story. Email is best. If you'd like to send it via snail mail, that's okay, too. I'd prefer it typewritten. Send it to the Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497. Again, give me a buzz if you'd like to chat, 888-815-9756. Memorial Day. It's a holiday that, goodness, we've enjoyed for so many generations, but the prototype of Memorial Day was all about those that were killed in the Civil War. That's right, we go back to 1866, and there's a little village of Waterloo in the Finger Lakes region of New York. The man from that area that sponsored the idea, initiated it, I guess is really the right word, was Henry C. Wells. He was a druggist. Now, at that time, there were veterans that formed their own organization so that the graves of the known dead could be decorated with flowers. Well, they started off with a day called Decoration Day, and it was celebrated for the first time on May 5th. Well, then the Grand Army of the Republic, the Union Vets Principal Support Group, picked up on the Waterloo celebrations and spread the idea throughout the country. So, back in the 1800s, right in New York City, 1873 was the year where it was established as a holiday, and every state in the Union eventually adopted it until it became a national celebration. So the history behind it is basically remembering those that have given their lives and who have, for whatever purpose, needed to be remembered because their lives did count. And many of the soldiers, well, if you talk to any veterans from World War II, there's a few left from World War I, but you also have the veterans of the Korean War and also the Vietnam War. We now have our veterans from the Iraqi War. It seems like war is going on always, someplace, sometime. And there will always be a need for the warriors. Historically, that has proven the case many, many times. And I wanted to share with you a story about Howard Baugh Sr. He is from Midlothian, Virginia. He was a captain in the United States Army Air Force. He was a Tuskegee Airman, in fact, in World War II. And this was his story. He said, the 99th and the 332nd had 32 pilots shot down or forced down in enemy territory who became prisoners of war. One came back and reported that when he was being interrogated by the German intelligence officer, he was asked, why do you people fight so hard for a country that treats you so badly? Well, he probably didn't have a good answer, and Howard said he didn't give that question a whole lot of thought at the time, and he said he didn't think any of the other guys did either. He said there's been some reflection on that question since then, of course. He said, the reason I was fighting was because I was fighting for my country, our country. This was our country. It was ours as much as anybody else's. We paid taxes just like everybody else. Same rates, too. We paid the same fare to get on the streetcar and had to ride in the back. We never considered ourselves second-class citizens. Other people might. We didn't. We didn't think we were lacking in intelligence or leadership or any of the other things that the Army thought that African Americans didn't have. We were doing what we had to do and what we thought was right to do. Looking back on it now, I still think it was the right thing to do. Warriors come from all kinds of backgrounds, from all kinds of economic levels. Male, female, it really doesn't make any difference. But respecting and honoring him is something I think that is very important. And I know many members of my family and my husband's family have had to, you might say, pay their dues in their own way. But it's because of what they were willing to do, the lines that they were willing to cross, that we do have what we have today. And we must be mindful of it. Because if we are not good caretakers of the present, we may not have the privileges in our future for our children and their children's children. It's an ongoing task. It's one that never ends. Because if you study history at all, if you know it at all, you'll recognize that when people become too apathetic, when they become lazy, when they become very assuming, when they become fat with complacency, it is then that there will be something or someone else that will come in and say, I know what's better for you than you do. Hey, let me take charge. Let me do it for you. And then all of a sudden, you become a prisoner. I was watching a true story last night about the Second World War. And I thought how often it is just a tiny group of people can take over and take away so much. And the only way you can ever defeat them is by being a warrior yourself and standing up for what needs to be taken care of. Brave Men, Gentle Heroes. That's the book that I drew the story from. I did the interview with Michael Takis a few years ago, and he had researched fathers and sons and what they had given and their responses to what they had experienced. It's a fabulous book. If ever you want to read it, it's really a good one. This is Donna Sebo. We're going to take a break. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. 888-815-9756. That's the telephone number to call into. We're going to take a break for just a moment. And when we come back, hey, I'm going to tell you how to clean the house. Maxine's way. I love Maxine. I just think she's a doll. So we're going to find out a quick and easy way. Take all of about 30 seconds, but we're going to take a break, and then I'll be back with you to share more good things. We'll be right back. Donna Sebo here.
Do you have a group, organization, or club that would like to have an interesting and dynamic speaker? Then you're going to want to have Donna speak to your group. She motivates audiences towards personal empowerment, giving them tools for their personal and professional success. If you would like Donna Sebo to bring a presentation to your next event, call Delphi International at 253-582-5604. That's 253-582-5604.
Enter the magical world of God's Kiss.
Johnny finds himself at the entrance to a large open valley, framed by high mountains rich in the brown-red colors of the earth. He stands in awe, even a little fearful of the mountain's great size. After all, he's just a little boy and not very tall.
God's Kiss is a beautifully illustrated children's book about a young boy's journey into a valley with children and animals from all over the world. They are gathering together to experience the wonder of love and beauty that will affect their lives forever. A talking book audio narrated by the author Donna Sebo accompanies this wonderful storybook, creating a special magic all of its own. This book package makes a wonderful gift for those special children in your life ages 3 to 10. God's Kiss book and talking book audio are only $19.95 plus shipping and handling, and the author Donna Sebo will autograph and personalize your book if you request it. Call 800-872-8852. You can also order through Donna Sebo's website, www.delphiinternational.com. That 800 number again, 872-8852.
Hi, this is Donna. Maxine, I just think she is a doll. And a friend sent this to me, Debbie did. She said, how to clean the house. She said, Donna, I'm sure you'd appreciate this. I know I did. I like it. They haven't come up with a self-cleaning house yet. I'm waiting for that. They come up with everything else. Let's get one that cleans itself. Okay, since we don't have a self-cleaning house, how do we clean house Maxine's way? Well, step number one, you open a new file in your computer. Number two, you name it housework. Step three, you send it to the recycle bin. Step four, you empty the recycle bin. Step five, your computer will ask you, are you sure you want to delete housework permanently? Step 6, calmly answer yes and press the mouse button firmly. 7, do you feel better now? Maxine said it works for me. Well, that's fine until I see dust bunnies chasing themselves around the floor. Then that wouldn't work for me. But anyway, Maxine, I love you. I just think that's absolutely awesome. Hey, I was going to give you some information on upcoming shows. Now, if you're interested, I'm going to be doing live programs. I've got 3 shows scheduled this month of June so far, and there may be some more coming up. But on June the 7th, which is a Monday, I'm going to be on a blog radio show with Janice Wilson, and we're going to be able to take callers. And if you'd like to call in, it's going to be from 7 until 8 in the evening. Now, the link is going to be in my email newsletter. The newsletter will probably be online on my website tomorrow, so you'll be able to just tap that link through the June newsletter and be able to get in, because it's really, really long, and I'm not going to give that all out to you, so you can do it that way. Also, on June 13th, or it may be Sunday the 20th, this is a Sunday, I'm going to be on Bipolar Radio with Susan and Bert. It's a talk show in California. And you can go to www.latalkradio.com, and that'll be at 11 in the morning on Sunday. And we have a call-in number for that show of 323-203-0815. Then on Sunday, June 27th, and at 3:30 Pacific, 5:30 Central Time, I'm going to be on WVOL 1470, which is in Nashville, Tennessee, with Denise Barnes. And she is going to be hosting the program, and her program is called Differences. So we will be on air together for an hour. We will be open for call-ins on that day as well, and the call-in number for Denise Barnes' show is 617-737-9865. So all of that is going to be available, again, in my newsletter that's going to be going out at 5:30 this afternoon. And if you'd like to be included on my email newsletter list, that automatically every month you'd get a copy of the newsletter with all the good stuff that's in it, all you need to do is send me an email. Send me an email, donna@delphiinternational.com, and say in there, Donna, add me to your newsletter list. And that's all you need to do. Be sure to put your name along with it, because I like to be able to have that to link up with your email. And we'll be ready to go, and we'll make sure that you will get your monthly newsletter. So again, Donna at DelphiInternational.com. 888-815-9756 is the phone number. I also have some other stuff to share with you, but let's talk about vacations. My goodness, we are getting so close. Kids are graduating from school. Families are going to want to do vacationing or take a break somewhere. Warmer weather does exist somewhere else on the planet, not necessarily in the Pacific Northwest at the moment where I am, but it is out there. California, Florida, Arizona, there's many areas in the country. New York even was having warmer weather than we were having here. So if you want to take a trip somewhere, there's a lot of special bargains out there. But here are some tips that I think are just absolutely wonderful. You know, with some airlines, they are charging amazing fees for baggage, taking it on board. Sometimes new baggage rules, dependent on the airline that you fly with, can add $100 or more to an already pricey ticket. So if you check your luggage online before you go, you might be able to reduce luggage fees by $5 or more on some airlines. And even better, find out about those airlines that don't charge. Now, Southwest Airlines allows 2 free bags, and JetBlue allows 1 free bag per trip. So you need to check on that. And I'm not sure about Virgin Airlines, but I believe that there is something there as well. Also, be aware the airlines fill their planes from front to back. So if there's a chance of getting any elbow room on the plane, the last few rows are it. Well, most websites will let you choose your seat online and show you which ones are already filled, so you can pick the least crowded row or section. And some airlines, I understand, are beginning to charge for the seats where you are automatically going to have a lot of leg room, and that's the emergency seats or, you know, right the very first seat right after first class. You want to be sure that you check on that, because you don't want to have any unnecessary fees. It's amazing. You really have to check these things out, because your ticket can be quite expensive. But I will tell you this from personal experience. If you get your tickets online, you often can have a very good savings. But airlines are changing, so you have to stay on top of things. Now, if you want to not worry about airlines, of course, you can always take a train or a bus. And sometimes it's just really a lot more comfortable. I have some friends, they don't like to go anywhere on a plane, so they'll take a bus or they'll take a train. Now, your train can take you, depending on where you're going, can take you a heck of a long time, maybe double, sometimes even triple the amount of time it would take to drive even. We've had this experience when we've traveled back on the East Coast. So these are things that, just little tips, just be aware. If you're not in a hurry, a train is a wonderful way to travel. It absolutely is. But compare apples and apples. If you're looking at your dollars, find out what it's going to cost, maybe drive. How do you want to do it? There's so many options that we have today. And, you know, there are things called Megabus and Bolt Bus. I've never heard of Bolt Bus. Amtrak, of course, we all know about that. There's just so many different ways to check things out. So use the Internet as a resource and as a friend. Also, you might want to check if you're booking a hotel, if you are a person that has a Costco card or you have a AAA card or something like this, always ask if they have discounts with that. Also check to see if the hotels offer special weekend packages, because many times in some cities, the weekend packages are super, super cheap, whereas during the week, they're not, because that's when most of the business travelers are in town. Or it might be just the reverse. So you need to check these things out. Also, check with the hotels to see if there are hidden fees for using internet, local calls, gyms, etc. If you ask the front desk in advance, you'll find out about these things, and you won't get tagged with extra charges. This is Donna Sebo. Tomorrow, we've got a wonderful guest. Hope you can join us. Remember, always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. We'll be back here same time, same place, right here on BBSRadio.com. It's a great life. Live it with zest. Don't be afraid of the tomorrows. Today is what makes your future. This is Donna Sebo. Talk with you mañana. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.